Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor for me to be here, I would say the neurological alien in this room, I guess. Thanks for the organizers for inviting me. Tough job if your time is already up before you start, but in the sake of time, I will try to keep it pretty short. And if the chairman doesn't like the term, then it's better to be short, I guess. So I will tell you in detail what ESUS means, but first of all, I don't want to hide my conflicts of interest. The main conflict is that I was part of one of the ESUS trials, and indeed this is the only terminated ESUS trial. There's another one which ended enrollment, is already not published yet. I will go in more detail later on. And I think all of you are familiar with the main clinical problem, stroke. So worldwide, we got more than 10 million strokes. And in Germany, we get a stroke every 2 minutes. That's the main problem. And cardioembolic stroke, we get every 10 minutes in Germany. Because as you all know, about 25% of all ischemic strokes are due to cardioembolic origin. And yes, of course, stroke is the most common cause of, second most common cause of death worldwide, and one of the major causes of disability. And we have more than 1 million people living in Germany suffering from strokes. So what about stroke etiology? And there is a classification which was published about 25 years ago, and this is a so-called TOAST classification. And this classification separates stroke according to the, I would say, most probable origin. And first of all, about 20% of all strokes are due to large artery atherosclerosis. As you can see over here, that's a typical territorial infarction in a patient with carotid stenosis. But of course, in those patients with atherosclerosis, there is another stroke etiology, and this could be hypoperfusion, so-called watershed infarction in a patient with carotid stenosis. And further, 20% are caused by a kind of a microangiopathic lesion. Typically, there is no vessel occlusion, as you can see in the angiogram over here, and more detail, these ovally shaped little strokes are so-called lacunar strokes. And they're more often found in patients with hypertension and diabetes. And well, that brings neurologists and cardiologists close together. About 25%, as I said before, are cardioembolic. And this embolic pattern, as you can see in the MRI on the right-hand side, is not a must-have. Can be, but a territorial infarction is also fine in a patient with AF or heart failure. I don't want to go in detail with a stroke of determined etiology. 5% think about vasculitis or dissection of the brain supplying arteries. But I will focus on stroke of undetermined etiology or cryptogenic stroke. And keep it in mind, about 1/4 of all ischemic strokes are cryptogenic. And that means that you either have two or more causes identified, carotid stenosis and atrial fibrillation, and you don't know what's the mechanism of the index stroke, or you have an incomplete evaluation. That's a problem even in Germany and in industrialized countries. Or in the most common sense of this definition, you have stroke with so far negative diagnostic evaluation. And there is a substantial recurrent stroke risk in those patients with cryptogenic stroke, as depicted here. Population-based data from the UK, and cut a long story short, you can see that the etiology is not so important regarding the recurrent stroke rate. And in those patients with cryptogenic stroke, you have a recurrent stroke rate of about 3 to 6% per year. So that's another important clinical problem. Well, and this is not a new idea, I guess. The longer you monitor regarding ECG monitoring in those patients with cryptogenic stroke, the more often you will find a first episode of atrial fibrillation. And if you use implanted devices, it's the right-hand side of this diagram, you will find up to 30%, probably 40% of all these patients, a first episode of atrial fibrillation. Doesn't mean that atrial fibrillation is always the cause of this former cryptogenic stroke, but it's important for secondary stroke prevention and just indicating that an ischemic stroke patient per se is at risk for atrial fibrillation on the long term. And if you focus on this diagram and one of these studs indicates a single study, I think all of you may come to the conclusion that it might be fair to treat ischemic stroke patients without known atrial fibrillation or cardiac source of embolism with anticoagulation. And this is not a new idea. This was done several years before. I will just demonstrate two trials, more than 1,000 patients with more or less mild stroke have been enrolled and randomized. You can see in the WARS trial comparing AZA to warfarin in a, you would say, inappropriate dose. And the second trial, the ESPRI trial, randomized patients and compared AZA to warfarin in the standard dose. And these are the results. We'll say once again, none of these patients had known atrial fibrillation at the time of enrollment. And as you can see, there was no benefit for warfarin in the WARS trial, and it was pretty the same regarding major bleeds. But if warfarin is in the accepted therapeutic range, then you might have a benefit regarding stroke and MI prevention, but this is offset because of the increased risk of major bleed. But interestingly, there was a sub-analysis in so-called cryptogenic strokes in the WARS trial, and there was, you know, a little better profile for warfarin. And there was another meta-analysis focusing on those patients in the WARS trial with an embolic stroke pattern, and they may benefit even more from warfarin, but the bleeding complication rates were never published. So lots of questions remained, and there was the intention to use the non-vitamin K-dependent oral anticoagulants instead of the vitamin K antagonist warfarin to compare to aspirin. But the problem was that the FDA requested an operational definition of cryptogenic stroke just to rule out those patients with competing stroke etiologies and to rule out those patients with, in so far, insufficient diagnostic workup. And that's why, you know, colleagues just sit together and define the so-called embolic stroke of undetermined source. And this is a non-lacunar stroke, and it has to be proven by imaging. And it is not allowed to have stenosis of the brain supplying arteries of 50% and more. So this is large artery atherosclerosis per definition. And it's not allowed to have a major cardiac embolic source. So think about atrial fibrillation, for instance. And the diagnostic requirement was an echo, but it could be transesophageal echo or transthoracic echo. And this is a major drawback, I think, of this definition. And all these patients had to have atrial fibrillation monitoring for 24 hours. And just remember the graph I showed you a minute ago. I think this is insufficient to detect atrial fibrillation as it probably should be done. But well, that's an operational definition. And keep in mind, even in industrialized countries, this sets a standard. And I think this is an achievement that you get these kind of basic diagnostic after stroke. Well, if you focus on real life data, then you pretty easily can see that ESUS patients are so a subset of the cryptogenic stroke part, and they are usually younger compared to probably those stroke patients with cardioembolic sources. And comparing different registry, you end up with about 10 to 20% of all ischemic stroke patients fulfilling the criteria of ESUS. And there are three trials. First trial, we go in detail with that, has been published, and this is a terminated trial comparing rivaroxaban to AZA. The second trial, and that's my biggest problem today, has been presented on the World Stroke Congress several months ago, but it's not published yet. I think the publication will be out within the next weeks, but it's not so far, and that's why, unfortunately, there's an embargo. That's why I'm not allowed to show you the graphs, but probably I will give you some information about the results. And well, there's another trial, the Atticus trial. This is still ongoing, aiming for 500 patients having a surrogate endpoint with brain MRI, but I will come to this later on. So, said before, Respect ESUS, there is an interesting design paper if you're interested, and just comparing dabigatran standard dose 150 milligrams twice daily to AZA, also double-blind, also randomized 1-to-1, pretty much the same compared to the Navigate ESUS trial. In the Respect ESUS trial, more than 5,000 patients have been enrolled, and in Navigate ESUS, we got more than 7,000 patients in more than 30 countries worldwide, as you can see over here. Rivaroxaban 15 milligram once daily compared to AZA. There was no dose reduction in those patients with renal impairment. And patients had to have an embolic stroke of undetermined source within 7 days to 6 months. And they had to be 50 years and older, 50 years to 60 years with additional risk factors, or 60 years and older to be enrolled into that trial. And well, that's the primary result, and that's why the trial was terminated, because of futility. As you can see, during a median follow-up of 11 months, there was no benefit of rivaroxaban compared to AZA with regard to recurrent stroke and systemic embolism. The trial aimed to demonstrate a benefit of 20%. It failed, obviously, and the main safety endpoint was major bleeding, and as you can see, there was a pretty clear bleeding signal for rivaroxaban, and this was pretty stable, even comparing life-threatening or fatal bleed or even intracranial bleed compared to aspirin. As you can see, 4 times increased, and this also holds true for other intracranial bleeds. So, what about subgroup analysis? I don't want to go in so much detail with this in the sake of time. As you can see, it was not a big difference. A lot of sub-studies will come up. There will be interesting sub-studies focusing on atrial cardiopathy, for instance, or baseline ECG markers, probably indicating a higher risk for atrial fibrillation. There was no continuous ECG monitoring during the trial. Few patients have been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation during the course of the trial. There have been dropouts and were set on anticoagulation, and the overall rate of atrial fibrillation was rather low in this trial. And just tell you the other part of this table, there's virtually no signal. Probably there is no benefit in younger patients, even those age 60 and younger, but we have to wait for further sub-analysis to go in more detail with that. Well, what have I learned? Let me give you my personal opinion regarding these randomized trials. First of all, this is the negative Navigate ESUS trial, and if you compare secondary stroke prevention in Navigate ESUS to, I have to say, primary stroke prevention in the COMPASS trial, stable atherosclerotic disease, but only 4% have a prior stroke, then it's interesting to see that there was also a comparison between rivaroxaban and aspirin, and a median follow-up of 1 year and brings you up here. So the curves are pretty similar to my mind. And after the first year, you get a kind of a split of these curves. And this is interesting because in the other ESUS trial, said before, there was a similar signal. The first year, the lines were totally in parallel, and afterwards, there was a benefit, but this was non-significant for dabigatran compared to aspirin. So probably the duration of the trial was not enough in Navigate ESUS, but to be pretty clear, even the Respect ESUS trial was negative for the primary endpoint, recurrent stroke. That's interesting, and whether a combination of low-dose oral anticoagulation and aspirin, as shown in the COMPASS trial, is interesting for ESUS patients, nobody knows. But this will be an interesting target for future studies. Well, so probably an embolic pattern should have been chosen. I said before, it's ridiculous in a way that they call it embolic stroke, but it's not an embolic pattern. But if you focus on those patients with embolic stroke pattern, you end up with about 10% of all the ESUS patients. This same holds true in the Navigate ESUS trial. So this would reduce the number of ESUS patients applicable for studies to probably 2 to 5%. But it seems pretty logically that these patients may profit from oral anticoagulation, probably more effective in preventing ischemic strokes in those patients with so far undetected atrial fibrillation. Next question is, should the definition be changed to be ESUS plus additional risk factors, probably those patients with cardiopathy? It's an interesting trial, the Acadia trial, now randomizing more than 1,000 patients with stroke and having hints for an atrial substrate. But I think randomization has started, but it will last at least 3 years to get new results in this regard. Or another question is, do we have to have an ESUS plus additional risk factors for atrial fibrillation as the treatment of atherosclerosis with a NOAC is obviously not better compared to aspirin? And this is an interesting single-center observational study from Tübingen, Germany, 75 patients with ESUS and at least one of these risk factors, for instance, atrial run or large atrial enlargement, and they had a detection rate of atrial fibrillation within 1 year of 35%. In Crystal F, you get 3 years 30%, and if you enrich this population, you probably end up with a higher rate of atrial fibrillation detection, and this is the basis of this Etikus trial. So the Etikus is ESUS plus additional risk factor, but the problem is that recruitment is rather slow because you have a problem to find these patients, especially if you have, as a neurologist on the stroke unit, just 2 or 3 days to go, and otherwise the patient goes on to the rehab clinic or to the normal ward. So Etikus aims for 500 patients, as said before, but it will take another 2 years to get the complete enrollment. So should we have transesophageal echocardiography in all of these patients? Yes, I think we need something like this because it's kind of a fire and forget anticoagulation approach obviously is not useful. So this should be treat to target, and we got information from Navigate ESUS, but the problem here is that only 20% got in transesophageal echo and 80% got it transthoracic, and that's why you don't know how many patients really had a persistent foramen ovale. In the subgroup analysis, there was a signal towards a better efficacy of rivaroxaban compared to aspirin, but as said before, lots of limitations, so you cannot take this for sure, but keeping in mind the results on the persistent foramen ovale occlusion trials in those patients younger than 60 years after cryptogenic stroke, I think those patients have to be excluded from the original ESUS definition. Well, to my mind, prolonged ECG monitoring is the key. It's an individual approach. So we just wrote a position paper from the German Cardiac Society together with the German Stroke Society, just a suggestion that every stroke patient, irrespective of cryptogenic or ESUS or a large artery atherosclerosis, should get 72-hour monitoring for atrial fibrillation if that's not known before the index stroke. And afterwards, you have to decide whether there is a higher risk for those patients to get atrial fibrillation. Then you should do a prolonged monitoring. If not the case, then it's probably fair to stop after 72 hours. And the data regarding the increased risk for atrial fibrillation after ischemic stroke is pretty clear. Yes, of course, older stroke patients have a higher risk. Those with supraventricular extrasystole, such patients with atrial runs have a higher rate of atrial fibrillation, or those with left atrial cardiopathy. And finally, let me summarize. I think stroke etiology remains cryptogenic at 25%. The vast majority of those cryptogenic stroke patients fulfills the criteria of ESUS. It's an operational definition. I think the basic diagnostic standard, that's the best thing these trials provided so far. But stroke prevention, there's no benefit of rivaroxaban compared to aspirin, and there's an increased bleeding risk of rivaroxaban versus aspirin. Interestingly, there was no increased bleeding risk of dabigatran compared to aspirin in the other trial. So I'm looking forward to see the publication in detail. So far, nobody has a clue whether there was a similar event rate comparing rivaroxaban and dabigatran in both trials, but the bleeding rate in the aspirin trial was much higher in the Respect-ESOS trial. So the standard of care is aspirin, and I think, yeah, we need a better name, obviously, and a more precise definition for ESOS in the future. And yes, of course, ECG monitoring is important, treat to target. That's my message. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you very much for this really nice overview, and I'm happy that we are back to monitoring of AF again. Are there any questions from the floor? Oh, my co-chair has a question.
Sure. Do you have any data? How many percentage of the ESOS patients had left atria pathology or PFO?
The problem is that in the mentioned trial, there was no definition of atrial pathology. Though, yes, there is blood samples have been drawn, so we will get a hint probably indicating the natriuretic peptides, things like that. They will be assessed. I think I'm looking forward to this sub-analysis, but so far this is not part of the definition. That's why, you know, would you have no imaging data? There was no MRI or not even detailed imaging. And second question, PFO, in those patients with transesophageal echocardiography in Navigate ESOS 27%, as it is the standard, so to say, because every third one in the room has a PFO, as you all know. And well, in those patients undergoing just transthoracic echo, it was 5%.
So. Yeah, so that means not more. So exactly.
So far, not more, but I'm looking forward to see the results of Respect ESOS and afterwards. But obviously, it's not 50% or 60%, which was published in cohort studies before.
Thank you very much for the very elegant and comprehensive overview. I think the results concerning bleeding in Navigate ESOS, they raise an important question. The reason why we have, one of the reasons why we have abandoned aspirin from thromboprophylaxis in atrial fibrillation was the finding in Everose that apixaban, 5 milligrams twice daily, has not an increased bleeding rate compared to aspirin. Now we come to Navigate ESOS, and this is suddenly not true. The increase in bleeding rate was 2.7, almost three times, with a low dose rivaroxaban compared to aspirin. So my question is, what is your interpretation of these data? Are these drugs so different, or are the patients so different? And doesn't it raise some questions about our abandoning of aspirin?
Yeah. First of all, I think the patients are different. So we are talking about non-AF patients. So that's the one issue. So I think you cannot compare the data to the Everose trial, especially because of the fact that in Everose you had 70% of stroke patients in there, but this is, you know, patients with well-known atrial fibrillation documented several times. I think this is a difference. The second thing is pretty interesting. The aspirin in the Navigate ESOS trial was enteric coated. And the event rate was much lower than expected. And comparing, indirect comparison, not fair, but comparing the event rate and the bleeding with rivaroxaban and dabigatran, it was pretty much the same. So the question is more or less, why is the bleeding rate using enteric-coated aspirin so low in the rivaroxaban trial compared to the dabigatran trial? This is a question, and nobody is able to answer this so far because of the fact that it's pretty tough to do if the publication is not out. But I would say the expected bleeding rate was, that's the main issue, lower in the aspirin arm, and it was exactly as expected regarding rivaroxaban. But we cannot draw final conclusions regarding stroke prevention, atrial fibrillation.